Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your hosts from 970 ESPN and Steelers Nation Radio, David Todd, and from SteelersDepot.com, Dave Bryan. Just a couple of Daves chilling, talking Steelers. Now, here's Dave and Dave.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave, Season 6, Episode 113. I'm Dave Bryan from SteelersDepot.com, sitting in once again for David Todd on this Friday, which happens to be May the 27th, is Alex Cazora. Alex, happy Friday, and how's your heart right now after that Game 7 that the Penguins won Thursday night?
I think we've both taken our first chance to exhale after that game. And, Dave, that one was a wild one. But congrats to the Pens. Can't wait to see them against the Sharks.
Yeah, absolutely. Setting up, this is what, the first time since, what, 2009?
When they won the Cup. Yep.
Most definitely it should be a great series. It's amazing the turnaround that team did, you know, early on from early on in the season. When I can remember back last night thinking about one of the early games before the firing of their other head coach against the Washington Capitals. I thought, oh man, there's just not, even if the Penguins make it to the playoffs, there's no way that they'd be able to beat a team like the Capitals, you know. But lo and behold, they did, and it'll be interesting to watch to see if they can finish this thing off now. Obviously, the Steelers have now wrapped up their first week of OTA practices that ran Tuesday through Thursday. I think the biggest news, I guess we can call it that because we really don't have specifics on it, is the fact that cornerback Cinquez Golson needed to apparently have an MRI on some portion of his body after Thursday's practice. And unfortunately, I think that's about all the factual, you know, elements that we could provide along with that. So how concerned are you?
I mean, yeah, I think there's a reasonable amount of concern anytime anybody goes under an MRI, much less somebody who we know, you know, was in a similar spot last year that, you know, tears his labrum during OTAs, and we didn't really know about the exact severity of it, you know, for quite some time until they finally canned him during training camp. So, you know, and it could just be a minor thing where they're looking, but this isn't just a regular checkup. You don't go to an MRI, you know, just to see how you are after a couple of days of practice. There's something there where Golson's alerting the medical staff and they want to take a closer look. So, you know, there could be a little bit of extra cautiousness in that regard. But, you know, you're not doing it just to do it, just to see how a guy's feeling. And who knows if it's related to the last year's injury or what. It could be totally separate. I mean, there's no specifics at all. But sure, I mean, this is a guy that, you know, this team wants to start him on the outside, and he goes down, it changes their plans yet again.
And, you know, after the first few days here, and there was so hard to know who to believe out there in the media right now, because one will report one thing, another will report another thing, just to kind of try to slap down another member of the media. But at first it was reported that Golson was running first team on the outside. Someone has since tried to contradict that. So, the media, obviously, I think, is discouraged from talking about pecking orders, unless they can get a player to admit it during an interview. And in fact, you know, we were kind of talking about that, I think, on the last podcast, Alex. I told you that I was going to try to get a hold of Bert Lawton to find out. I don't know if a lot of the listeners caught, you know, the kind of the backfire that the Buffalo Bills media had, you know, earlier this week when some of their new media policies were laid down to them at the start of their OTA practices. But it sounds like they can't report on anything for the most part. And I kind of reached out to Bert Lawton, and Here's the question that I asked him. I said, I was curious if you can share with me what the media is not allowed to report on during the OTA practices, and here's what he wrote back to me. He says, we pretty much apply the same rules in OTAs as we do during the season to keep it consistent. This also applies to what the media can videotape and such. Only time everything is fair game is training camp, since fans – and I'm sure he was thinking, Alex Zora, watch and report what happens. He says, hope that helps. And it doesn't. If it doesn't, let me know exactly what you're talking about, and he'll try to help. I fired back to him, can the media report during OTAs where players are lining up and with what string unit, or is that off limits for them? And Bert says, we try to let them know they shouldn't, and confirm that with the players themselves. So with all of that said, going back to what, you know, the train of thought that I had, some are saying that Golson ran first team outside cornerback. Others are saying that was Ross Cockrell. I think regardless, Golson was seeing snaps on the outside, so read into that what you will. It seems like Artie Burns was primarily on the right side, second team, and take your pick of Cockrell or Golson on the left side. It would make sense that this team would quite possibly give a guy like Golson every opportunity to win a spot on the outside. And, you know, if they go into nickel, have a guy like potentially William Gay moving inside. You know, we've kind of all already, you know, hashed this out several times. We're just going to have to see where the chips fall come time you get to training camp and can actually report on who's running where and when and what packages and stuff goes along with that. But with that said, there was a report that Golson gained, I think, 10 pounds since last year. I think the easiest thing, based on the news of Golson needing this latest MRI on Thursday, is to say, well, there you go. The kid's undersized. That's good enough. You know, that's proof that the Steelers shouldn't have drafted an undersized cornerback that early in the draft. Look, we don't know what he needed the MRI for, but I agree with you, you know, with the line of thinking of, you just don't go in there as a, well, let's see how this is getting along type of situation here, in my opinion. I think we even have a doctor that commented on the post Thursday evening saying, look, he's in there for a reason, because they want to check if something, A, is newly injured or re-injured. So we'll just have to keep our fingers crossed, you know, as it relates to him.
Yeah, and just to go back to where Golson was playing, you know, I said on Monday's podcast, my guess was that he was going to be in the slot, just kind of looking at the way the roster was constructed after last year and trading for Brandon Boykin, a slot corner, after Golson went down. But I wasn't, you know, positive. And if he is getting snaps outside and not inside, that does surprise me a little bit. I mean, it would then make sense that, of course, that, like you said, on third downs or any nickel situation, which is, you know, 70% of the time now, Gay will now be considered the slot guy. My question is Golson going to get reps both inside and outside? And can he handle all that, you know, still never playing a snap before? And if he isn't, then who's the backup slot guy here? Because I'm looking over this roster, Dave, and I can't find a name. Cockrell, Golson, if he doesn't do it, Artie Burns, and Duran Grant. You know, so that has me just, you know, it's very early, but it has me a little perplexed.
Based on what I know right now, and that's obviously not a lot, you know, but, I mean, like I said, we're not going to get a better idea until training camp, I don't think. Some media will convey it as speculation, even though they'll know it as fact, to get around, you know, the reporting restrictions. So we'll just have to kind of lean on the narratives that they take to kind of circumvent the reporting and all. Plus, it makes the media, each member of the media, look better when they correctly speculate things they already know the outcomes of. But with that said, you know, one would think it would be Gay than Golson as a backup slot guy. I think the fact that Gay's, you know, experience and knowledge and ability to communicate from that spot makes him, you know, the more likely of the two as we, you know, sit here right now based on what we know to be the starter. And then, as you said, you know, Golson would be the guy you would think could swing inside. But however, I've watched a lot of Artie Burns film, you know, over the course of the last couple of years or two seasons worth. And he saw significant amount of time in the slot. So perhaps that would be an option as well.
I just think that's a tall task for a rookie, and I think he's just too stiff. I don't think the skill set translates well enough for him to be able to play in the slot and cover some of these shiftier, smaller guys, you know, with that change of direction. I don't think Burns can handle it enough. But, yeah, I mean, I get about, you know, Gay, and the phrase that I always associate and think of when I think about why they want Gay in the slot is the hub of communication that the team was so adamant about last year, which is really critical and important, and I totally get that. But, man, I'd love to see Gay on the outside being able to match up against some of these number one receivers a little bit more often, you know, A.J. Greens and the like, because, you know, you without Gay, it's either Cockrell or Golson, and it's a little bit tougher challenge.
Yeah, I don't think we'll see Cockrell inside.
Yeah, I don't think so either, and I don't think we'll see Burns. I think they'll want to start him at one spot to begin with, and I don't think it's going to be in the slot. It's not going to be Duran Grant. I mean, it has to be Gay, and it has to be Golson. There's really nobody else.
Yeah, and I would think Burns would be the number three guy at best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, could you take, you know, Sean Davis? He doesn't, you know, there. It sounds nice to say that Sean Davis played cornerback at Maryland and can line up in the slot and this, that, and the other. But the fact of the matter, I don't know if you saw that, the cut up that I did from the Iowa game. I don't want him in the slot against anybody who can cut, because even though he has good straight line speed, I think it's obvious that change of direction and all, he's just not a slot guy. Mm-hmm. He's a break glass in case of emergency cornerback who really just needs to focus right now on safety and maybe lining up against bigger tight ends.
Remember that the Steelers tried that with Shamarco Thomas his rookie year. I remember against Chicago, and that got burned pretty well, so hopefully the team doesn't try it again.
He tried it against the Patriots, too.
Yeah, the results were not promising.
Yeah, that was ugly. I think, I remember, what was it, he had to guard Gronkowski one time, it seems like, in that game, and was Welker with him back then, or was...
I think he was.
I'm trying to remember if even Am... I'm trying to remember who the other smallish wide receiver, I can't remember if Amendola was even with him.
No, I don't think it was. I don't remember. I think it had to have been Welker. But
might have been, but I remember, smacking my head saying, oh, Lord, you know, put Shamarco trying to run with these guys.
Yeah.
As far as, we had a report about Artie Burns finally getting, as I like to say, getting to dance with Antonio Brown on Thursday. Thursday, of course, was Antonio Brown's first practice with the OTA practice with the team, and actually hard to imagine that really first practice since he suffered that concussion back against the Cincinnati Bengals, and the media tried to frame it as the two kind of splitting reps against each other, but I think the more and more you kind of read, AB had the other AB beat deep and an underthrown ball allowed Artie Burns to kind of have some makeup time in there and then subsequently defend the pass there. But, I mean, what are we really expecting here? I mean, this is the league's best wide receiver going against a late first round at best talent. Who is very, very raw. Some of the other things, was there anything else to come out you know, that caught your eye about the secondary in these first 3 days of OTA practices?
No, secondary related, not much, the little that we know. But to the point about, you know, Artie Burns versus Antonio Brown, I mean, Dave, what better, you know, training manual can you have for Artie Burns than going against Antonio Brown every single day? Yeah, Burns is going to take his lumps, but that's going to make you better. I mean, greatness molds greatness. And it's, I mean, there's no better test and way to get better than facing AB every single day.
The only downside I could see is that you're confident.
But when you get out on the field, these guys are going to feel like nothing compared to AB. So, you know, it's it's like you're taking the test now, and then, you know, once you get in the field, that's your practice almost.
And as I wrote back Thursday evening, you know, you would have – when and if the Steelers talked to Artie Burns during the 2016 Combine, and you would think that they probably asked him that question of whether or not he thought he could cover AB. Mm-hmm. And really, you would be disappointed if he said that he couldn't, mm-hmm. you know, as far as a confidence standpoint goes. And it – cornerback is such a fickle position from the standpoint, and you hear Mike Tomlin say this quite a bit, and you heard Ike Taylor talk about this throughout his career. You have to have a short memory. Mm-hmm. You really, really do, from play to play, and you can't get too high and you can't get too low. And really, although it was generic in nature, I really liked the soundbite that Artie Burns gave. You know, following yesterday's practice, you know, just trying to get better and that kind of thing. As far as the rest of secondary goes, I think with Mike Mitchell missing time this week or really sitting out per se with, you know, as he continues to rehab his shoulder, it sounds like Shamarco Thomas and Robert Golden were running first team with who would be next? Sean Davis and...
I think Shamarco was the report for second team safety.
That's
what you had written in your notes the one day, right?
What did I wrote? I wrote Golden and who else? I thought it was Shamarco running first team. Did I not write that?
No, I'll have to go back and look. I don't want to say something wrong, but I thought I don't know what I thought actually.
I'm pretty sure. Let me. You got me kind of concerned about this now, because if Mike Mitchell's out, that leaves Shamarco Thomas and Robert Golden running first team. I don't think we ever found out who was working the second team. Let's see here if I can find it. Let's see what I have written. And these were reports compiled off of several different media outlets here. I don't have who the second team was, so that's probably why.
But have the first team, Robert Golden and Shamarco Thomas, were the starting safeties on Tuesday, yada yada, so there you go. No surprise.
Correct,
no surprise.
Correct. Yeah, no surprise there. And you know, Sean Davis, obviously is going to have to work himself up the depth chart. I would not be surprised if he bypasses Shamarco Thomas at some point here in the coming weeks or months here. What else stuck out to you maybe as far as well, let's talk a little bit about some people that were not able to work mm-hmm. for injuries or for whatever reason. Mike Mitchell, because of that shoulder, obviously, and I forgot to put this in my initial pre-injury rundown. Ladarius Green, coming off that ankle surgery, we're probably not going to see him until training camp at the earliest. James Harrison, obviously, you'll see a lot of him in sweats right now. Kicker Sean Swisham with that knee. Wow, who am I missing here? Le'Veon Bell has been limited. That's, in my opinion, that's great news mm-hmm. that he's out there running around. Marquise Pouncey has been, from what I consider, a full participant, even though, you know, no pads are involved here. Matt Spaeth, I kind of get the feeling that Matt Spaeth has been limited. Are you kind of feeling that as well?
It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, he was an every other day kind of guy in training camp, so I'm sure OTAs are just going to hold him out.
Anybody else you can think of that I didn't run down?
No, you mentioned Mitchell with the shoulder. What other guys had off-season surgery? I think what the Castro had a little something, but he's in there. He's full go. No one major. Just hoping the Golson MRI is not serious.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, which direction should we go now from things that people are writing about?
Well, just to touch on, you know, the two guys that are returning, Pouncey and Le'Veon Bell. The thing with Pouncey was, I know you saw the comments, is that he confirmed that he had more than two surgeries. He didn't put an exact number on it, but at least 3 to 4, just to kind of really, you know, put a concrete way to think about all that he's kind of gone through to work his way back. Man, that is, I can't even understand the amount of rehab and just determination it took for him to get back.
And he declined to have Thursday off, evidently. I mean, he said when he showed up on Tuesday that he's not you could just tell that he's so glad to be back on the field again. And you know, after missing, geez, I mean, when you consider basically two full seasons out of the last three he's missed, he's ready to play football. And evidently he was given the opportunity to take Thursday off, and he declined it. And I don't know about you, Alex, I'm tipping my hat to him on that. I hope he does take a couple of days off here throughout the OTA practices and on into training camp, because we know how important this guy is to this team, and he doesn't have anything to prove in my eyes, and I've never considered. I think using a label like injury prone is just so easy. Is a label so easy to use? Mm-hmm. And I don't consider a guy like, let's say, Le'Veon Bell or a guy like Marquise Pouncey as being injury prone. I usually think associate that term with a player who has a lot of soft tissue type of injuries. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess you could say a guy like Lamar Woodley late in his career, yes, injury prone. But I don't like to associate that with a guy that. Really, I call Marquise Pouncey wrong place, wrong time prone.
Yeah, that's a perfect way. Yeah, broken fibulas aren't innate to really, you know, most people. So, yeah, I don't consider it either. But, you know, the reality is that you have a guy that has had a ton of work done on his lower body. He's coming off of 3 to 4 surgery a year. You don't know exactly, you know, what kind of player he's going to be. He can say all the right things, and he's determined, and you can tell that he's excited and also angry about all the time that he missed, and he's excited to be back. But you don't know exactly what kind of player you're going to get coming off of this very, you know, severe and complicated journey that he's been on. And there's also, you know, I'm not sure what the numbers are, but there's also, you know, the chance of re-injury. Are you at a greater risk now that you've gone through all that you've gone through? The long-term, you know, effects, ramifications. It's hard to think about this guy playing when he's 33, 34 with all the work that he's had done. But, you know, we don't know that for sure. But, you know, so when you do talk about his injuries, yeah, I don't like to talk about injury prone. It's a meaningless statement anyway. But you worry about some of the effects it's going to have on his future.
Yeah, either you're on the field or you're not, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
We don't know a lot, but let's run down these rookie draft picks, and maybe you've heard something I haven't. Maybe I've heard something you haven't. Artie Burns, we already discussed, really, you know, for 3 days worth of practice. There's no reason to read anything into 3 days worth of practice. Mm-hmm. But from what I can tell, he's represented himself well. Sean Davis, really, there hasn't been a lot of reports, period, about him. I think I heard one member of the media says really hasn't stuck out at all. So, you know, probably not surprising 3 days of practice here. Javon Hargrave, I think the biggest thing that I take away from Hargrave is just some of the things that Cameron Hayward has had to say, and I believe that took place on Wednesday, and I wrote about it this morning, basically saying the kid's got to grow, and it's not like they're depending on him right now. Hayward just really was downplaying the fact that they needed a guy like Hargrave to kind of make an immediate impact, whether it be on the base defense or in the sub-package defense. When kind of pushed further on his early thoughts on Hayward, I thought, you know, Hayward was straightforward. He said it's only day two. If everybody was good after day two, we'd have a Super Bowl now. And here's where he gets specific. He's got a great motor. Hayward says, goes on to say, he even saw a little film on him, and you can see the way he runs to the ball, and that's expected here. He says he's got a great first step, built-in leverage, and if he continues to grow, he could be a contributor, big contributor for us. really no new information there. That's everything that kind of we've kind of talked about and others have talked about that they've seen on tape with him so far. Outside of knowing that Gerald Hawkins, the Steelers' fourth-round selection, got initial reps on the right side at right tackle, which we kind of knew was going to happen thanks to Mike Munchak's post-selection press conference. I don't think I've heard anything else on Hawkins, have you?
Nope, not much. Not much on most of the late-round guys. Nothing on Feeney, nothing on Matakevich. Ayers is in the return line, and they want someone other than Antonio Brown to get the job.
Yeah, and you know, Eli Rogers and Ayers obviously would be the two most likely candidates to do so. I don't think you do it just to do it, although it kind of sounds like that they're aiming that going that direction, right?
It does, and honestly, Dave, and I might do an article on this for Monday or something, I don't agree with the idea at all. Yeah, I understand, you know, worry about, you know, could Antonio Brown get hurt on punt returns, but, you know, since when does Tomlin live in his fears and worry about injuries? You can get injured at anything. You know, so Antonio Brown is going to be the best player of the competition, no matter what Ayers and Rogers show, and I'm sure they're going to show some positive things. End of the day, Brown's the guy that has the trust and has shown the big playability. I mean, he's got everything you want in a punt returner. So there's no, you know, objective, logical reason to take him off. It's just the injury risk that's driving you, and that's not a good way to go about it.
Being as how there's so many fair catches now in punt return, what would you say the average amount of punt returns a game are now for a team? Two?
Yeah.
Three at max?
I mean, I could do the numbers real quick, but yeah, it's probably two or three. You know, Antonio Brown's not a super aggressive guy the way that, say, a Pac-Man Jones is, who rarely fair catches the football. He's a guy that knows when to shut things down and just make the safe, smart play.
So 2 to 3 less car crashes a game.
But they're not even always even car crash. They could be running out of bounds or just a real kind of soft tackle. I mean, really, what is the? When was the last time a punt returner got hurt?
Sure, and I go this way because I lean to your side here as well, too. And what gets me, too, is when you hear someone say, well, they could always just put him in for a spark. Well, he should be – the guy back there – fielding punts every time should be the guy that can best give you the spark.
Right, right.
Right?
Yeah, it's like building a fire and not using, like, tinder and then or whatever it's called. And then, you know, it's just silly. I mean, if that's the guy that gives you the best spark, use the best spark all the time. To do anything else is stupid. It's putting, you know, what is it, a square peg in a round hole. It's just they did this last year with Jacoby Jones, and obviously it fell extremely flat on its face. No one liked it. Antonio Brown didn't like it. Danny Smith didn't like it. I don't know why they're going to go down this well again.
Why do you – it really makes you scratch your head why they did what they did last year with Jacoby Jones, right?
I mean, yeah, I guess I can at least understand the kick return aspect of it, and I guess they wanted to get Jones out there as much as possible to help justify the move, and they wanted to try to take some of, you know, some things off Antonio Brown's plate, I guess. But yeah, it's not a great reason for it. It's the same situation this year, Dave. You know, Antonio Brown's going to be your best guy. This is the only position where you remove your best guy to put in the second best or the third best guy. It goes, you know, absolutely counterintuitive with everything you know about football.
And when you go back to I started this conversation off by saying, boy, it sure looks like, you know, that they are dead set on having one of those two win the spot regardless. Mm-hmm. When you go back, it sounds like this whole thing has been kind of staged right from the moment the pick was made and Danny Smith was sent out there to talk about a wide receiver. And look, okay, I will buy the fact that he was deemed on the Steelers board as being the best punt returner in this year's class. I can be sold that. But on the flip side, this was a guy that caught 90-something passes last year, and they make it sound like they just drafted a punt returner, which that might very well, you know, end up being all he'll end up being in the NFL. But if you go back to when Dree Archer was drafted, it made me sick to hear Colbert compare him to Mel Gray, mm-hmm. you know, who he had in Detroit there. If you can prove to me that you can win the job, that you're the best punt returner on a team, you need to be the best. You need to be the punt returner on a team. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't. If you can't, then AB needs to be back there.
And again, is there anyone that's going to say, regardless? And I like Arrows. I mean, I thought he did some positive things at Houston last year. I like Rodgers. You know, he's shown a flash. But no matter what they do, is there going to be any debate that Antonio Brown is the best punt returner on this team by the end of camp?
It really would have to be – I really will have to see something during a preseason because obviously that's the only time I'm going to get to see it myself.
Right, yeah, and Ayers and Rodgers, you know, that work's limited. I mean, what you do in training camp and during practices and stuff, I mean, you're just catching out of the big kind of, you know, kickoff jugs machine that they have. That's not simulating much of anything. You're on air during that whole time, so you're only getting, you know, a couple opportunities in the preseason. And if it's Ayers or Rodgers, even if they show some talent, their first snap in the NFL in week one will be their very first snap ever in the NFL. You know, why would you go from a guy like Brown who has all the trust in the world, this is not his first rodeo, and then you put in somebody that's doing it for the first time? I think it's actively harmful to your team.
And speed is extremely overrated.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah. Well, it's not. I mean, Ayers and Rodgers, that's not how they win. They're not super 4-4-3 kind of guys. But you know, Brown is a playmaker, and he does it like you said, and not just with pure speed, but you know, elusiveness and change of direction. He's a smart guy that gets upfield right away. That doesn't usually do a ton of dancing. A little bit, you know, it's still AB. But he's got everything you want for in a punt returner. So I mean, if you want to create a competition. Sure, but I mean, you just don't – the way that it's being framed, and maybe this, maybe the reports are not totally accurate, but the way this is being framed has me concerned.
Let's see. Outside of Kanan Severin catching at least one touchdown in some 7-on-7 type action, I don't think I've really heard too many undrafted free agents talked about over the course of this past week. That's not overly surprising. I think I read that Xavier Grimble, one of the backup tight ends, is in amazing shape. So I can't wait to hear you kind of report about him. Even though, you know, this is a guy that I'm pretty convinced right now is a practice squatter at best. We heard a lot of positive things out of Cameron Hayward on Daniel McCullers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad he's positive about him because I don't think you, I, or David Todd are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Hayward was – it was like a scouting report of Daniel McCullers. He certainly said some good things, but Hayward had some – you know, I guess you can call it criticisms, but, you know, he framed it in the right way, saying that McCullers has to learn to play with better technique, and if he can combine, you know, of course, the natural size that he has with his technique, then he's going to be a good player. He says that he needs to be more vocal, that he's kind of a quiet guy, and I think Hayward said they kind of have to pry the words out of him, and he made the point, you know, as the nose tackle, you're the one calling the huddle and getting the alignment set for the defensive line, and so McCullers has to be, you know, he's like a big old teddy bear, but on the field, he's got to be a little bit nastier, and that's kind of been the story for a while now. I remember Joe Green, I don't remember the exact comments, but he was kind of talking about that we need McCullers to be, you know, a more aggressive and nastier, kind of edgier player, you know, in the way that Joe Green was. Joe Green was, you know, they didn't come much nastier and edgier than Mean Joe. So while Hayward did definitely talk up McCullers, and it looks like that, you know, he's going to be given that first opportunity, you know, there's a long way to go.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing that caught my ears while listening to Hayward talk is him talking about McCullers having surgery during the offseason. We were never that was news to me, and you know, we're guessing here that it could possibly be related to the knee injury that he suffered early on in the season against the San Francisco 49ers when I can remember doing the post on that, mm-hmm. You know, and cutting a gif on that of him being kind of cut. There was a penalty, I believe it was on Eric Pears,
yep.
on that play. And I think McCullers ended up being down, what, a game after that?
I think so. Yeah, he was on the injury report for the Rams. I think he missed the Rams game. I don't know if he was on there any longer. But, yeah, he could have broken his leg. I mean, I put the gif back in the article I did on that yesterday, Dave, and it's almost amazing he didn't just, you know, tear his leg up because that was a nasty hit and an awkward fall.
And we're just guessing, as far as, I mean, for all we know, it could have been a sports hernia, you know. And if it was, God bless him, because that would definitely – here's the thing. He did not make this improvement that several had hoped he would during his second season. I've written about this. You've written about this several times as well. Where was he in the sub packages? Mm-hmm. You know, if why didn't you have confidence to use a guy? I can understand if we're talking about a guy 6'1", 320 pounds, more so not seeing time in a sub package. Then I can't a guy that's 6'6" and change and well over 300 pounds who we have seen actually drive a few people backwards, in some pass rushing opportunities. Why didn't you have confidence to put him on the field in key situations, in sub package situations, last season? That's concerning to hear Cameron Hayward talk now. They need him to be able to, you know, they need more out of somebody this mm-hmm. year. Whether it be, the guy they picked up, help me out, Ricardo Matthews, somebody's going to have to help alleviate some snaps this year. And let's just hope this isn't just lip service by Hayward talking mm-hmm. about McCullers.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Steelers' defense, the only position – I mean, I'll maybe this is a rhetorical question, but let me get your answer on it. The only position you could say that they've, you know, regressed on is nose tackle, right?
As far as regress?
Yeah, like they improved it at corner. They improved at safety by the, you know, all the pieces that they've added. Nose tackle's the only one where there's a chance for regression, right?
As far as starting capable goes, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Steve McClendon to Daniel McCullers.
Yeah, and I think Hayward was smart. Look, we don't want McCullers to be Steve McClendon.
Mm-hmm.
Here's where I worry the most about this in his early down situations against the outside zone.
Yeah, and, you know, just that ability to flow down the line, you know. And the AFC North runs so much, you know, zone stretch concepts, whether it's Baltimore, Cleveland, or Cincinnati. They all do it, and they all do it a lot. So you're facing that, you know, at minimum six times this year. McCullers has to be able to do that, and that's my big concern with him. Yeah, he's been shown the ability to hold the point of attack well enough, and he's got a decent effort and motor. I don't question that in the least. But, you know, it's just simple lack of athleticism since he's such a freaking guy.
And where McClendon, I will just say this to the day I die, very underrated flow down the line outside zone defender. In fact, I would go as far as to say probably one of the top two true nose tackle defenders against the outside zone was Steve McClendon. Mm-hmm. And that's big shoes to, and look, teams are going to pick up teams that have mobile offensive lines and can actually run that are going to run that against the Steelers, especially if you have a guy like McCullers mm-hmm. in there. The thing about Javon Hargrave is we don't have enough film to know, mm-hmm. right? So it'll be interesting to see what kind of you know, zone stretch defender he is as a 0/1 defender. Because quite honestly, I can't tell you that because I haven't seen enough film mm-hmm. on that. And because there's not enough film available on that. So I have my concerns about the initial start of the season nose position.
Yeah, I think if there's one position that's we should be concerned about that probably isn't getting talked about enough, because everyone talks about the secondary and the pass rush and, you know, defensive end depth and rotation guys. But yeah, nose tackle. Because even though 3-4 is being kind of phased out, you're still in it for 300 snaps. You don't want 300 subpar quality snaps out there. That's going to kill you. So, and if teams realize that you're struggling to stop the run, you know, in that 3-4, they're going to go heavier more often, and they're going to start trying to dare you to stop it. Everything for Pittsburgh still, even under Keith Butler, is revolving around, you know, that strong front seven and stopping the run. And McCullers has to be able to play to that same standard.
And they did that last year. Thank God they mm-hmm. did that last year on early downs, yeah. you mm-hmm. know, because if you're giving up 4 yards on average or more a carry on first downs. Against the run, especially when you know it's coming, it's going to make your defense a lot harder to call your defense on second and third downs when you do not have the opposition behind the chains.
Yep.
Plain and simple.
Yep.
If you can get a opposing offense in second in eight or second and seven situations, it really makes play calling a bit easier, mm-hmm. in my opinion, on a guy like Keith Butler, who already, you know, that we've seen a few players now this past week say is a lot more aggressive, mm-hmm. than Dick LeBeau was during his time. Anything else? What else did we learn during the past 3 days?
not much, Dave. It's
Well, that's going to be the wrong answer for our listeners.
I know. I'm trying to come up with something, but there's just not a lot out there. You know, like you mentioned, the whole, you know, issue with the Bills media policy and some of the beat guys up there kind of having fun with it. I was sitting there going, well, yeah, that's the way Pittsburgh's been for years. Why are you guys all mad about it up in Buffalo?
Basically, we're at the mercy at the narratives that the media throws at us.
Yeah, it's not, you know, I think narrative has that negative connotation, and I want to be careful of that. But, yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, they have to be very careful about what they say and how they get their information. And like you said, sometimes they say things that you're not sure if that's reporting or not, but they're trying to convey it as reporting, even though, you know, they have to frame it as speculation. And then you're not really sure, you know, what is fact and what is fiction. So it's very difficult to try to wade through all that. Just to finish up the last point on McCullers, I was reading the Dale Lawley's practice notes yesterday, and he said that McCullers wants to get down to about 340. He's been listed at 352, of course, so I think some, you know, shedding a little bit of that weight might help McCullers' movement skills a little bit as well.
Let's see. We have, you know, it sounds like they got some sound bites from Todd Haley. I'm guessing after the mini camp, this just went up on Steelers.com, so I'm trying to read it as I talk here. He's not providing any, you know, much information. You know, you want to lay the foundation of what you're doing offensively. I know where I wanted to go. You know, there was a report right after I think the first practice that Wheaton lining up a little bit more outside with the possibility of Sammy Coates. Potentially, and I use that loosely, being groomed as more of a slot guy. In my opinion, that kind of makes some sense, and especially being as how the things that we saw Sammy Coates really do at Auburn, and the fact that he is probably the second best blocker on the team right now.
And you're saying Coates is the second best blocker?
Yes.
I mean, that's a limited body of work to really determine that. I think Wheaton shows a lot of
quality. Well, I'm trying to be kind of funny when saying yeah. that, because we haven't seen a lot, but I think if you go back to watching his college tape, yes, Wheaton, and who, you know, DHB probably
the best.
Clearly the best,
and I would put Wheaton second just for the effort that he shows.
Okay, third best blocker.
I mean,
then.
I guess Coates, because AB is known for a lot of things. Blocking is not one of them.
And you go back to what Richard Mann said about Coates after he was selected, about, you know, big enough to and enough effort to dig out safeties, mm-hmm. and things like that. I can see, and look, we talked about this, I think, last offseason. You don't want to put a player out on the field in a specific situation. And I think this goes back to kind of conversation we had with Darius Hayward Bay. If you put Darius Hayward Bay out on the field and in the slot, and you only run out of those mm-hmm. formations, the teams are going to catch on real mm-hmm. quickly to what you're doing. However, I think Coates can potentially be a better slot player than he could potentially be a Z, you know, an outside player. Agree or disagree?
I don't really have a great feeling one way or another. What is your opinion that he's better in the slot than he is outside?
I just think with his ability after the catch, some short area stuff, assuming he's able to sharpen up his route tree, which was very, very limited coming out of Auburn. Make no mistake, though, he put up some exploits. And I remember writing about this after last year's draft, and it kind of, even though he doesn't have the same speed, kind of the same M.O., that Kanan Severin has coming out of Virginia, a lot of explosive plays, but really nothing else. And that was kind of the MO of Sammy Coates coming out of Auburn, right? Go big or go home.
For sure. Yeah, I think the thing for Coates is that, you know, you're just playing inside. You have to really have a high IQ. You're running a lot more option routes now. You're being a guy that's being relied and trusted upon much more, especially on third down. Remember, that was a talk with Wheaton last year that he was going to be the big guy on third down. So, you know, you better trust him, and he better really make sure he can read a defense and read it on the fly.
And I view Coates' college tape as seeing some combative efforts across the middle. Heck, what was it? The game against Ole Miss, right? With Golson in coverage. Also, while timed fast enough, I don't have the feeling that Coates is a Martavis Bryant.
Yeah, I mean, he's a tick below. He's not that long kind of fluid strider that Bryant. Well, Bryant's just such a unique guy in so many different ways. But I mean, I think Coates is certainly, like you said, fast enough.
So where do you see? Who would you rather see as starting slot in? I think it's obvious because of experience factor. Yeah. It's going to be Wheaton and Antonio Brown. But let's say 11 personnel. Darius Heyward-Bey is going to see some opportunities. But if you get a guy like Coates on the field, where are you hoping to see him the most in 11 personnel, slot or outside?
I think what Pittsburgh does so well is that they move guys around, and this is the beginning of my non-answer to you, Dave. But I think that, you know, they're able to create matchups, you know, week to week based on what kind of, you know, defenders they have, size, speed, you know, talent. You know, everyone gets moved around, even though the Wheaton played a lot inside because of Bryant. Even Bryant got slot work for some of those slot fades that Pittsburgh loves to run. AB gets work in the slot a ton to try to shake some of these top corners. So the thing that I like about Wheaton playing outside more is I think it's going to give him a little bit more of an opportunity to be a vertical threat and run some more downfield routes. Because remember, he's got speed. I mean, he's a guy that can make some big plays. You think about the Chargers game last year and the big touchdown he had from Michael Vick. You know, I think that's going to give him a more opportunity to create some of those big plays, and that has me excited about that for Wheaton.
Yeah, I think that's the way I'm going with that as well, too. And if you go back to even his college days at Oregon State, he was another he had his fair share of explosive plays, and it seemed like he did so more so when he was outside.
Did Wheaton finish last year with the best yards per catch on the team? I think he actually led for at least a while. I'm going to look it up right now because I think people didn't realize and didn't give him the credit for some of the big plays that he made last year.
What do you mean? Yards per catch?
Yeah, yard.
Well, that would have been Bryant easily, right?
I think it was – I'm trying to think back, but you might be surprised on that, actually.
I'm gonna try to
ratio to it because obviously I think intuitively people would say Bryant or AB, but remember Wheaton had, you know, he didn't have
he did. He had 17 yards per catch last year. Wheaton. Now he did have the 72. Now 17 yards per catch, 15.3 for Bryant and 13.5 for Antonio Brown.
See? So there's an action. It surprises you the deep threat that Wheaton can be.
And here's the thing. How many other balls should Wheaton have had of 20 yards?
There were,
or
I think, a couple, yeah. I can't remember the specific ones off the top of my head, but there were some missed opportunities. So yeah, I think Wheaton is – I mean, he ran, what, low 4.4s coming out of Oregon State. So this guy can fly.
44 catches, 749 yards. He did have the 72-yarder against the Chargers. However, I mean, let's be fair. Martavis Bryant had an 88-yarder in several big plays there. How many? Oh, here's the thing. How many explosive plays did the two have last year.
Oh, I'm not sure on the exact number. I mean, that's more your speed. I know you have those numbers in your back pocket all the time. But, you know, I think Bryant probably – I don't know. I don't know who would have had more last year. I mean, looking at the numbers, it might have been Wheaton.
I will find this out for you real quick here. Maybe it was well, here's the thing. We know it was probably a lot because he's never been a Yak guy. Mm-hmm. Talking about Marcus Wheaton. Let's see. If you had to guess how many explosive plays Marcus Wheaton had during the regular season, throw out a guess.
All right, and
for
it's 20 yards or more is the threshold for explosive. Yes. Okay.
Correct.
44 catches. I'll say that 10 of them went for 20 or more.
Great guess. Nine.
Okay.
Martavis Bryant had 10. Antonio Brown, 25,
yeah,
of course.
More receptions, though. To be fair.
It did seem like Wheaton's yak average went up some last mm-hmm. year. I remember that being the
yep.
big topic of conversation last year during the offseason and practices and during training camp here. So, you know, maybe they're going to exploit Wheaton, be able to get down the field a little bit more. Now, while that could possibly cut into maybe his production catch number a little bit, and never, you know, it wasn't like he was a big 6-7 catch a game type guy
mm-hmm.
anyway. I mean, obviously the offense runs through Antonio
right.
Brown. We would expect a guy like Ladarius Green to have his fair share of contributions in this offense and helping to replace Martavis Bryant. Obviously, you're going to have Darius Heyward-Bey to some degree platooning with Sammy Coates at some point as well, too. So I guess where I was going with this all along is I'm kind of rooting for that to happen, and I'm kind of rooting for Sammy Coates to kind of get his fair share of snaps in the slot
mm-hmm.
along with Darius Heyward.
Yeah, yeah, I think that, again, people can't discount DHB because I think he's going to be a bigger threat than people realize because he's the veteran, a blocker, the trust, yada, yada. Yeah, Coates has got to take advantage of his opportunity is the bottom line. And then just to wrap up the Wheaton point, Wheaton, his 17 yards per reception last year, ninth in the NFL. So that's really impressive.
Ninth in the NFL based on how many catches.
I don't know what the minimum was.
What
I'm
was
looking
the minimum?
Off a Pro Football Reference. They don't list the minimum. Let's just assume that it's probably like 25 catches or something.
Okay. It'd be interesting to see what that is if the minimum was 40. I could figure that out. It wouldn't take too long. We'll be able to do it on this show. That's too much
too much math and toe counting
right now. Anything else stick out to you?
Not that something we've talked about, but just something I've inferred. Although it's unfortunate that Ladarius Green is out with his ankle injury, man, Dave, what a great opportunity for Jesse James to get those first-team reps. He's still the third youngest guy on the roster right now. He isn't even 22 yet. So this is a great chance for him to get those first-team reps in a low-pressure environment. I'm really excited for Jesse James this year.
Yeah, I would agree. I'm excited about that as well, too. Although I would like Green there sooner rather
of course.
Than later, just to get on the same page and learning the offense. But let's face it, this guy's been in the league for 4 years. He comes off as a relatively smart player. Sure, he was limited in the Chargers offense playing behind a guy like Antonio Gates, but sooner rather than later, they're going to need both those guys quite a bit this year, talking about both Green and mm-hmm. Jesse James as well, too. But it is good to hear Jesse James getting some extra work early on, and hopefully some of these other younger tight ends mm-hmm. like Grimble are taking advantage of the work as well,
because real quick, the big thing I want to see out of this Steelers offense, because, you know, it's running so well, and of course it's hard to really, you know, knock it. I mean, you're nitpicking, but I want to see this team be a better passing threat out of 12 and 22 personnel.
I've been calling for that
mm-hmm.
for years.
I know.
And have never gotten
it. They didn't have
it.
A guy like Green, a big move tight end, and a guy that can be that threat. I mean, they go 12-22 last year. Matt Spaeth is in. I mean, you basically have a six offense alignment, and I think it hindered the offense.
Well, even if you were able to run your 12-22, if Jesse James takes a step forward with his blocking mm-hmm. this year, It because of the way Matt Spaeth has declined, to me, the gap has narrowed significantly as far as what he needs to do to become what Matt Spaeth is now. Now, does that mean that at least it's a step in a positive positive direction? Now, here's the thing, and it's what I've been kind of calling for quite a while. If you have at least one of your two tight ends that can function as a better than average end of the line tight end, blocking tight end, if you will, having the personnel, that kind of personnel to run 12 and 22 really opens up a lot of possibilities for you offensively. We've seen the Patriots do it for years. We've seen the Bengals be able to do it, especially when they had guys like Gresham and Eifert's early days there. You can dictate to a defense what you want, you know, what you want to do at that point, right? Because if you see them go small, and by small across from you meaning a nickel's sub package, you can go large by going one or two tight ends attached to the line of scrimmage. We talk about 22 too, you know, with a guy like Nix. In there, boy, he really played well as a fullback last year. And on the flip side, if you're in 12 and you see your opposition go big against you, talking about their base unit, which generally means they're only going to have four defensive backs on the field, you could take a guy like Ladarius Green or, for that matter, Jesse James and split him out and then try to create you some matchups there. So, I'm going to quit talking about that because I get too excited about that every off season and it never happens.
Well, it's happening. Be excited.
Yeah, so, I'd like to see it implemented more during games, I would say. But the problem therein lies, who are you going to leave off the field?
Right, yeah. I mean, there's a balance to it. But, you know, Pittsburgh likes to go heavy. They've opened up several games going heavy. I think, you know, Haley does a nice job of being able to kind of throw teams off balance, you know, starting things out. You expect them to go with their 11 personnel, but there's games where they've come out empty. Remember the Rams game? They were empty to start. There's games where they started out heavy, you know, in their 21 personnel or 12 personnel, things like that. So, like you said, Dave.
But here's the thing. When they're in 20, when they've been in 12 or 22 in the past, Matt space just an extra offense.
Yeah, no, I'm not trying to disagree. Like I said before, that was the issue. Is that when space came in, that's exactly what I said. You have six offensive linemen. So now that you've added, you know, Darius Green and Jesse James is going to make the jump and become the number two tight end. It's going to give you that flexibility, so you can still do everything you want to do in 12 and 21 and 22 personnel. But now you're going to get that added receiving threat. And like you say, when you're coming in those heavy packages, defenses are going to respond by putting out their base. So now you're getting tight ends on linebackers, and now you're going to have some chances to win.
How great is it, would it be, to have two tight ends that you could seemingly, depending on what, really on what you see across from you, run the one of the most, outside of running the power to the right side, I love RPOs.
Mm-hmm. I know.
I absolutely love run pass options. I think to watch John Gruden's face during the Gruden football camp. I think it was with Goff, to see him just floored by the RPO concept, that one face that he made.
Yeah, I know what you're talking
about. You know, I just think it's so underrated because it takes a lot of the guesswork out of audibles. It's such an easy play to run, and if you have the dominant personnel while running it, and if the right choices are made, you're going to succeed. Mm-hmm. I mean, I shouldn't say you're going to succeed. Your chances increase dramatically of succeeding. And when you look at the Steelers' personnel, the offensive line and the talent at running back, regardless of whether it's D'Angelo Williams or Le'Veon Bell, when you look at the possibility of having guys like Ladarius Green and Jesse James, when you look at the wide receiver options, regardless, A.B., Wheaton, guys who can run that smoke or the bubble as part of that RPO, How do you stop
it's,
that?
It's very difficult. It's going to keep many defense coordinators up asking themselves the same thing. But, yeah, I mean, Pittsburgh will run some of those plays, to the, those RPOs to the tight end all the time. I think about their probably their staple, which is their swing seam with a, usually an inside zone concept. They're going to pair it with tight end down the seam, number two receiver, running a little flare route, and then you have your zone concept if you want to run the ball depending on your box count. You have, it's not really an RPO, but they have the one they love to do where they'll pull the left guard, Ramon Foster as a false key and then get the linebackers to cheat up and then hit, the Y down the seam. Big plays off of that. You're flexible, you're multiple, you can play fast, efficient, and get big plays. I mean, it's harder to create a better offense than that.
And here's the thing, boy, we could, here we are at an hour and we're just, I'm just starting to get fired up because we're going more X's and O's right now. How many times have we seen the Steelers hit with that Y cross?
A lot, yeah. And well,
their defense.
All the time, Cleveland, every day, they just kill them.
Right, and how many times do we see the Steelers be able to run the Y cross successfully for big,
not
big yards?
Not a ton, not often.
Now, and God bless him. Heath Miller just can't get downfield.
Yeah.
Now you have a guy. Well, we saw Jesse James run that Y cross at Penn State,
and we know Green has the skill set to do it.
Yeah. Imagine running this off play action now. Imagine having the, kind of that RPO and that RPO look per se. Because you ran it two times during the first quarter, and in the second quarter you give that same look, and then you run play action with it, with some false keys in there with the Y cross.
Yeah, I mean that's usually how it's done. You come out heavy, you give that look. It could be a short yard situation, a second and two or something like that, and you hit him with play action, and you get those linebackers up because the front seven they're reading their run keys. That's their first responsibility. They're run first. And you just need a step, and now that you have athletic guys and James and Green to be able to create some separation behind, it's going to open you up. And Todd Haley does a fantastic job of using one play to set up another. I've covered that many times over the last really 2 years with him. So absolutely, you can use one play to set up another.
And I think very underrated is the fact that how many times, and the use of that RPO by Haley. I love it. I've written about it. I wrote about it like 2 years ago in a series of like seven or eight plays run in one game. That, especially when you have a guy healthy like Le'Veon Bell, you have an offensive line back healthy with a guy like Marquise Pouncey at center. The weapons that this offense has, they really should be, even without Martavis Bryant. Now, obviously, you're going to miss a guy like Martavis Bryant because of his ability to take top off of coverages. But, if this offensive unit stays healthy, it really is exciting now with the addition of Green to this, of how explosive they can be. And I'm not just talking third and long. I'm talking early down explosiveness.
Yeah, Dave, I know we're running long here on time, but, just like Ben said, the goal is still to get 30 points per game. We'll see if that happens, but if there's a team that can do it, it's Pittsburgh.
Let's see. Let's wrap it up. The Ravens are going to lose their OTA practice next week. Not overly surprising. You break the rules that number of times. Just absolutely no excuse for John Harbaugh and the Ravens to get busted for something as simple as that, as practicing in pads at their mini camp. Harbaugh was fined as well. Anything else? Congratulations to Ben Roethlisberger. He became a dad for the third time a few days ago, and it looks like Landry Jones became a father as well, either the day after or the day before, right around in there. So congratulations to both those guys. I think we already hit on Alan Faneca being at OTAs this year. That's exciting news here as well, too. Jarvis Jones really didn't say much outside of using the option year snub as some motivation. Boy, we'll be back on Monday, Alex, and I think it'll be both of us once again, and we'll kind of look forward to kind of things that we hope to learn in week two of the Steelers OTAs. But for now, people can follow me on Twitter at Steelers Depot. They can follow Alex on Twitter at Alex_Kazora. They can follow David Todd at David M. Todd. They can email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. They can donate by going to SteelersDepot.com and clicking the donate button as well. And as always, Thanks for listening to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave.